President Brown, thank you, as ever. My friend Lou Gibbs, the wonderful soloist we heard a moment ago, Beth. We met at Cedarville, and I was so smitten with her extraordinary gifts that I went to the president and said, there's a woman in Cedarville, Ohio, who we really should have come to the White House and sing. And he said, why is that? And I said, well, because I think that she's beyond extraordinary. And he said, let's get her here. And we did, and she came. She sang for the National Day of Prayer. She was a huge hit, and what a blessing. And I've come to see that people like Beth and Lou, your president, Bill Brown, are forces of nature for good. In fact, I should say you are a force multiplier for good. And every time I come to Cedarville, I leave more inspired than the time before. I was saying to my friend Lou last night on the way from the airport that this is the only place in my time with President Bush, there are only seven of us left who began with the president when he was still governor, although I'm the only non-Texan. And I was saying to Lou that this is the only place that I have visited three times. And I hope, at least in part, that is a sign of the real honor and respect that I hold for this very, very special place. I was going to come with a plate full of politics and policy, except for in my car ride with Lou last night and in my breakfast this morning, that I've come to see that yours, which is an extraordinary generation, you're the 9/11 generation, that the conversations I keep having with your generation, and I do a lot of traveling and I meet with a lot of young people. I'm going to Yale on Friday, although I have a feeling it may not be as friendly of a crowd. I've come to see that one of the things that preoccupies this generation is what it is that you're supposed to do in life. And I've come to see that the life of discipleship is not narrowly defined as doing church-related activities, or even as that of witnessing to Christ here on campus. I've come to see that your vocation embraces everything that you as a Christian are and do. And so I'd like to spend a little time, if I may, talking about vocation. And my prayer for each and every person in this beautiful place today is that your vocation become your avocation. That you are passionately in love with what it is that Christ has chosen for you, so that it's not just going to work or getting a paycheck. And let me say, as a fellow brother in Christ, that if your vocation is to be the President of the United States of America, or if your vocation is to own a lawn service, if your vocation is to be the governor of Ohio, or if your vocation is to be the manager of a Borders bookstore, that I promise you, God will honor whatever it is you choose to do as you glorify His name. And I'd like to take a step backward, if I may, because I have a grand uncle who is British, and I've heard your president talk about his love of England and the British Isles, and so I thought this was appropriate. My grand uncle's name was Sir Cyril Connolly. And he was the headmaster at a very well-known college in England called Marlborough. Some of you may have heard of it. Sir Cyril, as he was known, had a very definitive view of education. And he found a remarkable way to meld together two big questions. The first question is, what is the purpose of an education? And the one directly related to that question is, What is the purpose of the Christian life? And I'm very pleased to tell you that my granduncle saw these two questions as one question. Because he believed, in my view, in the best of the English tradition, that education in its ideal form should be encapsulated in a few words: service, selflessness, chivalry, honor, sacrifice, loyalty, character, and intellect. By the way, Sir Cyril always put intellect last and character first. Always character over intellect, and not the other way around. But he always believed that at its heart lay the Christian religion. Not just spirituality in a broad sense, but an unswerving faith in Jesus Christ. And he believed just as firmly that the enemies of education were the vices of selfishness, greed, individualism, competitiveness, and above all, he would say, atheism. I want to quote for you, if I may, from a bit of a commencement address that he delivered in 1886. Here's what he said. Into that world, it is the business of a school, if it is a great school, to send men whose standards are completely different, men whose bare word is as good as their oath, who are incapable of being bribed, who will not tell lies either to make a big profit or to secure an important appointment or to win an election or to besmirch an opponent, who will not tell lies for any private or public end. They will not be tempted by anything that has money in it, if there is also dishonor. Into that world, the great school, he said, will send men who will do justice, not only, he said, in the courts of law, but in administration, who will be fair and humane to native races, fair and humane to those whom they employ, and who will not stoop to do a dirty job, even if it appears to be the material profit for their country. Honor, truth, justice, beauty. These, he said, are the eternal values, not money. Money and economic power are things that are seen and are temporal. But, he continued, the things that are not seen are eternal. They are the traditions of a great school, and they are the Christian religion. He said, you are not learning to win Olympic championships on the Marlboro playing fields. He said, you are learning to serve and to make yourself fit to serve. And in all your work here and in all your life here, he said, you are learning the same great tradition. And what is that tradition? He said, it is the business of a great school to find ways for its young people to serve God and country. So what is it, I would ask all of you this morning, from all the places from which you've come and all the big discussions that you're having with yourselves and with other people, what makes for a good life? I'm not asking what it is that you want to do for a living. What is the measure, I would ask all of you, of true greatness in this human life of ours? I would also ask you, can it be measured or weighed? What is the purpose of a well-lived life? The Westminster Confession of Faith famously concludes, that the purpose of a well-lived life is to know God and to love Him forever. And I think this is incongruous with the traditional values of piety and family responsibility that are the cornerstones of a successful life, which I know that you have learned over and over and over again from your parents. I have to take a step back, though, for just one moment, because I remember being a sophomore at Indiana University in Bloomington, and I had my first exposure to a book called The Republic by the great Greek philosopher Plato. Now, I was preoccupied and mesmerized by this book, and in a way that I look back and see that was actually abnormal, I read it 3 times. But I do remember reading it for the first time. And the reason that I was mesmerized by The Republic is because the whole aim of the book is to show that justice and the virtues of wisdom, courage, and moderation are in everyone's best interest and are required for true happiness. And I thought to myself, as a Christian, is that the case? And I remember thinking that this search begins anew, I suppose, with each person who comes to ask him or herself the fundamental questions of human existence. And I think it's possible that this is the conversation that each and every one of you is currently having with yourself. The big questions. Who are we? Why are we here? What separates us from animals? I remember Plato asking this question: is man a slave to his desires? What is our soul? I remember him asking, what is the function of human reason and our ability to think? Do we have a higher nature that can rise above greed and lust? Does might make right? Or does right make might? Do we have a higher purpose than self-gratification? Should we ever return harm with harm? What is moral principle? Does moral law precede civil law? And if so, does it do so every time or just sometimes? The wonderful thing about questions like these is that they are really problems that are not solved. And that's the challenge, I think, for each and every person at Cedarville today. These are big questions that must be lived, and each decision that you make will impact, ultimately, the question of your moral conscience. I have to tell you that it is easy to speak of these ideals in the abstract. But isn't it better to think of the life well lived less in theory and more in the lives of real human beings? Another philosopher I became preoccupied with was Aristotle. He said something that I've never forgotten and I've spent my life internalizing. He said that greatness is the ability to translate wisdom into action on behalf of the public good. I think that's what Christ did and does, and what makes Jesus Christ peerless and singular for all time. Because in order to do this, you must have a combination of moral virtue, practical wisdom, and public-spiritedness. In the simplest of terms, I would argue that it is difficult enough to know what is good for ourselves. But for the truly great among us, man or woman, they seem to have a deeper sense of what is good for the larger public. Intelligence, Aristotle reminded his charges as a truly great teacher, intelligence was not enough because practical wisdom is not something that can be mastered through training. Do you have classmates here who are truly virtuous? Are there those among you who are of the highest moral excellence? I'm not talking about the man or the woman who you know who is able to ace every single test and who has the highest GPA average there ever was. I've come to see in my 18 years in Washington that a good part of the world is run by B and C students. Let me give you a practical example. I met Michael Jordan one time. He is among the greatest basketball players ever to grace a court. Being from Indiana, basketball is in my DNA. I also met Jack Nicklaus. He is the greatest golfer ever, period. But I remember saying to my two sons, having met Michael Jordan and Jack Nicklaus, that it was their technical and their physical proficiency that was the heart of their great athletic ability. In other words, is it technical or physical proficiency that we are speaking about when we speak of the great men or women? The answer is no. I think not, at least not categorically. Greatness of the soul, I would argue, cannot be measured in purely physical or mental terms. It is the projection of the vision of the soul. In other words, it's probable that the greatest person at this university could be an A, a B, a C, or a D student. But the greatest among you is the one who has the greatest moral excellence. Character and integrity over intellect. How to think about all of this, and particularly in your life? Here's what I would say. I think the truly great man or woman has a central idea that motivates his or her life and for always. They also have a strong element of what I might call small d, democratic responsibility. What do I really mean by all this? I mean that they think largely of other people in remarkably free and equal terms, regardless of their wealth, or their status, or their power, or their education. Perhaps most importantly, the greatest among us has the gift of an extraordinary independence of mind and of imagination. What I think of as a kind of unconventional thinker who sees beyond his or her time to the larger good. This is a rare gift, Christ-given, I would argue. And it is in part what makes true greatness so very rare. Consider with me, if you would, and I just scratched these out this morning, four examples. Example number one, Abraham Lincoln. The man, I would argue, is probably the greatest president of the United States. He once wrote, and I'm quoting, "All nations have a central idea from which all its minor thoughts radiate." He wrote that when he was 12 years old. You could ponder that sentence for a lifetime and never get to the bottom. Abraham Lincoln's central idea, of course, was the Declaration of Independence. And he succeeded in giving our country a truly new birth of freedom. You know, of course, that he never went to school a day in his life, and from the age of 0 to 15, he only read two books, the King James Version of the Bible and Shakespeare. and you know that he memorized word for word all 37 plays. Winston Churchill, whose central idea was that the distinction between liberty and tyranny is real and substantial, what did he do? He helped lead a successful world war around this single luminous idea. That might seem trivial or obvious to us this morning, but stop for a moment and recall that contemporary values-free social science has gone a very long way in effacing the very moral distinctions among types of regimes. I would argue, in part, it's why we are so confused in our culture and in our time. What is the greatest threat to the United States of America and our way of life today? It is a combination of radical jihadism and nuclear proliferation. This toxic cocktail could destroy our way of life. And yet there are many days when many Americans and many of us who are blessed to live in Western civilization forget that there is even a war going on. Churchill never forgot. No compromises with tyranny is a giant and a good idea. And it was the heart of his greatness. Martin Luther King Jr. Now there was a great man. His central idea was that equality for every man and woman, regardless of race, was so utterly providential in design that it would always be larger than any earthbound law. And this gave his and he gave his life for that powerful vision. So did Lincoln. Lincoln and Martin Luther King Jr. were murdered for their ideas. Clara Barton. She was of a singular vision, too. I am intrigued by this remarkable woman. She had a view beginning at the age of 4 that service to others instead of self was irrevocable, and it emanated directly from when her first Sunday school teacher taught her the Sermon on the Mount. She told her mother at the age of 7 that she thought that there ought to be something that resembled a doctor without a medical degree. She was a great pioneer and revolutionary, and she actually ranked among some of the greatest generals of American history without ever firing a shot or mapping a battlefield strategy. I'll share with you an extraordinary story. I read last year the biography of Grant, easily one of our greatest generals. When he met Clara Barton, he said to a room full of his West Point peers, "This woman ranks me." This is the winning general of the American Civil War who told his fellow officers and alumni from West Point that this woman ranks me. In George Orwell's novel, 1984, the protagonists in the totalitarian society employed newspeak. This is the inversion of words to create false meaning. Do you know this novel? Let me give you an example. War is peace, good is bad, moral is immoral. These are merely a few of the possible inversions I'm talking about. While Orwell passed this mortal coil years ago, his notion of false meaning is too often projected into our time. What do I mean by all of this morning? I stand before you as a person who is a special assistant to the President of the United States of America. I have an endlessly long title, which means I have no influence whatsoever. And I have flown into another state to spend a few minutes with you this morning talking about the purpose of it all. Here's what it all means. A great president, Theodore Roosevelt, said, "Far better it is to dare mighty things, to win great triumphs, even though checkered by failure, than to take rank with those poor spirits who neither enjoy much nor suffer much." Because, he said, they live in the gray twilight that knows neither victory nor defeat. I have to tell you that God's signs are not always the ones that we look for. And they won't be in your life either. We learn in tragedy that his purposes are not always our own. Yet the prayers of private suffering, whether in our homes or in this wonderful university, are known and heard and understood by God Almighty. And I can tell each and every one of you, young people, that there are prayers that help us through the day or to endure the night. There are prayers of friends and strangers that give us strength for the journey, and there are prayers that yield our will to a will much greater than our own. And you can take heart in whatever vocation you choose, that this remarkable world was created by a loving God, and it is of a moral design. I'm sorry to say that in your lives, you will experience grief and tragedy and hatred because you have all chosen to take up the cross and to follow Jesus Christ. But remember, they are only for a time. Because goodness, remembrance, and love have no end whatsoever. And the Lord of life holds all who die and all who mourn in the very palm of his wonderful hand. And you will experience, I suppose, freedom and fear along the way. And you will experience justice and cruelty. But God is not neutral ever between them. And this is where all of us can take heart. And let me say one last thing, if I may. It is this, that we all are blessed to live in the greatest country in the history of man. That when you are an American, but particularly a Christian, blessed to live in America, each and every day is Thanksgiving Day. And I think it's a wonderful thing to begin every day with a little exercise, which is when you jump out of bed, drop to the floor, and say your morning prayers of thanksgiving and gratitude. The family and the church, all of your classmates, your professors, this extraordinary community is all off on a journey together to give all of you a remarkable life of purpose and meaning. And I can tell you, friend to friend, brother to brother, and brother to sister, that our remarkable country and our remarkable culture and civilization need you more now than it ever has. And the question is whether moral excellence and the virtues that do not change will be inculcated in your lives, and whether you will take up this remarkable challenge and lead your generation in this new time to heights that are beyond measuring. I mentioned Martin Luther King Jr. He said, "The ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of comfort, but where he stands at times of challenge and controversy. Ideas have consequences. Your country, your culture, and your civilization is calling each and every one of you from Cedarville. And may God richly, deeply bless each and every one of you on this remarkable joy of journey that you are off on. Thank you all. God bless you, and God bless the United States.